Welcome, Dr. Lee.
Thank you so much.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Glad to see you all once again. I'm excited about this last session, mainly because the first two sessions are really designed to be intense and teach you a thing. This last session is about snippets of the beloved community that are real, that are actually happening, that help us to imagine ourselves in the Word, and gives us points of entry. And so this is what I call the exhale from the intensity. But I want to begin as we began yesterday with lingering thoughts, questions from sort of our talk about the work. Did you all scribble some notes about the work that might be available, opportunities for you to do, anything you want to share, something that has an angel spoke to you in the wee hours of the morning and gave you divine revelation about what should be the Lord's doing in this place? I have to say that, you know, the Spirit's always at work and holding, but I was remarking with Jason this morning about how it's remarkable how we don't plan, teaching faculty don't sit down and plan together, but yet there is this wonderful synergy that happens, and there's this overlap that's taking place between all of the sessions. It's gentle, right, and sparking, and I think some of that is y'all, that's my Virginian, y'all doing it, where, you know, you go on to both sessions and you see these connections and you bring them up, and we don't know them necessarily, but they happen in these powerful ways. So I think that's divine moments. Those are divine moments themselves. So with that, I want us to look more intimately at a vision. And most visions are limited to sort of the person that sees, but the responsibility of a good preacher is to name the vision for the community, all right? So to say what you see to the broader community. And so that's what this session is really about, is sort of listening to some stories that I'll be sharing with you all and then reflecting. But I want us to, in listening to these stories, I want us to be cognizant of the cost. Theologically speaking, in a very basic sense, the crown that we will wear costs us a cross. The crown that we shall wear in the great eschatological truth that is Christ's return costs us a cross. Really, two crosses. One is Christ's cross, and the other is our own. However, in the reality of our Christian identity in the modern era, for many of us, we don't want to take up our crosses. I would submit that for being white in America in the 21st century, the cross that every white person has to bear is the cross of racism. Whether you want to or not. In fact, Jason Mann said it better yesterday in his session on sin. But that's what every white person is born into. That's the original sin of being American. But building beloved community is not just about racism. It's about classism. It's about sexism. It's about overcoming all of the various isms that we live in. And so it costs us something. So when you hear these stories of the work that it took to build a very brief glimpse of the beloved community, I want you to listen to what it might cost. And we'll talk about each one of those when we listen. And then I want you to be thinking, if you're taking notes, be thinking about the places and spaces that these stories bring up in your mind about your own community, where you could enter in at some level. So, quick review of our theological precepts from Strength to Love. First, beloved community holds accountable. Second, beloved community creates spaces for neighbors. Third, members of the beloved community are interdependent. And fourth, beloved community celebrates unity and difference as co-equals. So, I don't know why that slides like that, but for Dr. King, the beloved community is a theological claim on our shared life together, right? And it's a claim, it's a hope. And if you want to read more about the beloved community, we can talk afterwards. There are several texts that are really good about exposing the beloved community as Dr. King named it. One of the books is entitled The Beloved Community. One of the authors' name is Zapp, Z-A-P-P. I can't think of the other. It's a little off text. What is interesting is that when Dr. King talks about the beloved community, there is an aspect to beloved community that is not yet, and that will only be revealed in Christ's return. And that's not an excuse not to do anything, but it's a recognition that it will not be perfect what we build. It'll be incomplete until Christ's return, right? But it's bigger than the church, right? So there's this now and not yet principle that's at work in even the beloved community. And so here's some of the stories, right, that I want to talk about. So first, what I want to do is present a glimpse from Dr. King. So each one of these will have a glimpse of Dr. King's vision in 1950s and 60s. And then I'll talk about the 21st century and its opportunity. So this comes from the same sermon we've been dealing with all week, accepting responsibility for our actions. And he tells a story, and again, the sermon is really talking about our propensity to blame other people for our stuff, right? And so the whole sermon is ultimately about accepting responsibility for our actions. And so what he says is that there is a Marian Anderson, right? You know who Marian Anderson is, the opera singer. Born in poverty-stricken area of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, she could have very easily given up in despair and cried out that she was born in the wrong environment, vis-a-vis victim, right? But she was not one to make excuses. This same Marian Anderson rose from a poverty-stricken environment to be one of the world's greatest contra altos. So that a Tuscanini can say that a voice like this comes only once in a century, and a Sibelius of Finland can say, my roof is too low for such a voice. There is a Roland Hayes, another singer, born on the red hills of Gordon County, Georgia, under the most crippling restrictions. At a very early age, he found himself working in an iron foundry of Chattanooga, Tennessee. But from these red hills of Georgia, he rose to the palace of Queen Mother of Spain. And from this iron foundry in Chattanooga, Tennessee, he rose to the palace of King George V. He was a tenor and was able to perform in these places, not able to perform in the United States. And so part of what these stories sort of embody for Dr. King is that our responsibility is to not just blame others, but to take responsibility for our own selves and do what we can with what we have and be better as a result of it. And in so doing, in Marian Anderson's body and in Roland Hayes' body, become for the world an example of beloved community, right? So they show us our best selves and shame the systems that keep us from being our best self. Mm-hmm. Right? Shame is one of the most healthy emotions. Mm-hmm. Conviction is what that's a good theological term. Shame. Right? Nothing better than to say to someone, there were some white, this is another example of beloved community, some white supremacists who invaded a reading of at a bookstore. Politics and Prose is a famous bookstore, series of bookstores in Washington, D.C. that's sort of trying to reinvent the French Revolutionary Cafe kind of thing. So lots of readings, lots of different things in D.C., so there's stuff all over the place. So they're doing a reading of somebody's text. I think it was either Baldwin or Langston Hughes. And so these white supremacists came in with bullhorns and started, you know, chanting some ridiculous slogan. And this old black woman stood up, and this is caught on the newsreel, because everything's videotaped in the 21st century. This old black woman stood up and just stood at them and said, "Shame." And then one by one, everybody stood up behind her and said, "Shame." And it was like this, it was like from Game of Thrones. They just yelled, "Shame." And it was the most surreal moment, but you know, these big burly white guys just kind of took the bullhorns and right? And it just, and then they sat back down and resumed the reading. It was like, "Shame. We're not going to fight you. We're not going to call the police on you. We're just going to call it what it is. You should be ashamed of yourself." Right? Which is, you know, when I see that, then I say to people, if you don't know what to say when something like that happens, shame. Right? Don't wait till after it happens and then say, "Oh, what a shame." If it's happening in front of you, you have a word in your lexicon now. Shame, and make sure you get a stern look on your face. Something your grandmother would give. So my grandmother would give, for sure. But this is his vision. And what he's talking about is, despite Jim Crow segregation, despite classism that leads people to be born in impoverished situations, these people found ways to be accountable to their best self and become more than what they ever thought their birth circumstances would be. That's his vision. In Alabama, particularly in Montgomery, Alabama, there is an institute called the Equal Justice Institute. How many folks have heard of the Equal Justice Institute? The Equal Justice Institute was founded by a lawyer by the name of Byron Stevenson. Byron Stevenson wrote an excellent book entitled Just Mercy. If you don't have that, that's another book title that you should get. Just Mercy is the telling of the wrongful conviction of an African-American man who was sentenced to death row and who subsequently to the Equal Justice Project, DNA evidence exonerated him. But in so doing, he humanizes the story of the prison industrial complex and the racial overtones there with it. Brian Stevenson went on to found the Equal Justice Institute, which is a private, nonprofit organization that deliberately educates folks about the connection between racial injustice, poverty, and the criminal justice system. And you can go on a pilgrimage to Montgomery, Alabama, and visit the Equal Justice Institute Museum, which is about the size of this building. But in Montgomery, Alabama, that building about 150 years ago was the slave warehouse, the auction house. Yeah. And so it's been turned from its historical purpose now to education. Oh, the irony of that. But at the Equal Justice Institute, in the museum, you will learn the direct connections between slavery in America and the current practice of the prison industrial complex. That in America, Jim Crow, slavery, Jim Crow, and the current prison system is a continuation of the legislating of black and brown bodies. Such that when you start in virtual slave pens and you hear their stories. Right? So they're computer generated images that tell the stories of these slaves, which are taken from the 1930s project that recorded the Smithsonian Project that recorded slave narratives. From there, you move into a hall that has sort of a timeline of how we moved from emancipation to sharecropping to prison leasing. Folks know what prison leasing is? So, and you can read up on all this. And as I shared with somebody, the more that you read, just be prepared to be angry at your country and angry that you were born in white skin. So, beginning right after emancipation, like 1866, and running into the 1920s, the state and local governments in the South and in some northern countries, northern states, entered into partnership with their sheriff's department so that if you were caught stealing and you were African American, you were arrested and taken to the jail. The judge, who may have been in relationship or who was in relationship with the local landowning families, would sentence you to 90 days hard labor to be decided by the sheriff where said labor would take place. The sheriff and the judge would decide that there was cotton and tobacco to be picked, and so would then lease you his prisoners out to the local farmer, and thereby got labor. In so doing, the farmer would pay the state 20 cents an hour, 10 cents an hour. And it was all legal, because the judge sentenced you to hard labor, and the sheriff was determining who could do what. But in effect, what you got was slavery under a prison system. And this became widespread. And it was constitutionally sanctioned because the 13th Amendment has an additional clause in it. Anybody know what it is? Anybody know what the 13th Amendment is?
It's the one about no, there isn't slavery except for commission of crimes.
So the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery. It's a language. Except, and see, I don't think my phone, I can't do both, because I usually keep the Constitution on my phone. I can read it to you. You know, in these days, you should have your Constitution on your phone at all times. But the 13th Amendment says that this amendment abolishes slavery with the exception of punishment for crimes committed. And that became the basis for prison leasing in America. Right? And so, up until the 1940s, and the Equal Justice Institute has evidence going to the 1960s in Louisiana and Mississippi, a just punishment for crime was to work the fields. And some folks who grew up in the South can remember driving along the street and seeing prisoners working on the side of the road, right? You can still remember that, right? Well, in the South, they picked cotton. And so you had slavery all over again. All of this is exposed. Now, why is this sort of hopeful? Because you can go and hear these stories and understand the work to right wrongs. And I think the most powerful testament to the righting wrongs in this country is the image that's placed here. In Montgomery, just down the road from the museum, is the National Memorial commemorating lynching in America. And I highly recommend that, you know, Montgomery, Alabama is not exactly the vacation, hot vacation spot, but I highly recommend going to do a pilgrimage to learn about lynching in America. I think something like 46 of the 50 states had at least one lynching in a period from from colonial times until the 1970s. Here, at this memorial, under this...
The battery wall?
No, it's on. Sorry. Under this awning are, I think, 800 columns. They're 6 foot tall. They are the dimensions of a coffin. And they hang from the ceiling. And they start in chronological order, they're in alphabetical order, sorry, and by county. And the counties, there are 800 some odd counties represented across the country. And on those columns are all the names of the known victims of lynching in that county, across the entire country.
Frontline did a whole program on this.
Yes, good. Dan.
I was just wondering if you could comment on the degree of terror this inspired, that lynching inspired, because sometimes I think the numbers don't communicate.
The raw fear.
The fear
yeah.
of everyone.
Yeah. So I went hiking this morning. Sorry, I tell a story. Chuck and I went hiking this morning, and this goes to Dan, your exact point. African Americans are taught you do not go in the woods with white folks. Period. No exceptions. Nothing good happens in the woods with white people. Period. No exceptions. Because for African Americans who are reared in the South and thereby in northern places as well, woods and white folks mean clan rally, which ultimately means somebody's going to die. So you don't go in the woods with white folks. Ever. Period. And that's because of the terror of white supremacy as personified in lynch mobs. Google, to get a sense of this, Google Tulsa, Oklahoma riots. That an entire section of Tulsa, Oklahoma burned to the ground. Bombed, in fact, by the white population in Tulsa for an aggrieved infraction. Emmett Till, who was but a boy, killed for a lie. The woman who accused him on her deathbed recanted and said, "He did not whistle at me. I was forced to say that." The terror that was instilled by lynching is best told by the Equal Justice Institute. But there are stories of black merchants, black landowners, who just by owning their land was a threat to the white community, and thereby lynched. A black man in South Carolina who owned 200 acres of land went to sell the seed that he had at market. He knew the market price. The market owner was going to pay him 60 cents on the dollar for the market price. And the black man said, "No, you're going to pay me full price. This is my seed." The market owner said, "This is what you're going to get, and that's final." And in frustration, the black man, slammed his hand on the fist, like slammed his fist on the, "That's what we, you're going to give me my money, right? Or I'm taking my seed." No, so he grabs his seed and walks out. On his way out the door, the market owner hits him in the back of the head with an axe handle. He falls to the ground. The sheriff is called. The sheriff does not arrest the market owner. He arrests the black man. The story is told for his own safety. He's put in jail. A mob breaks him out of jail, chases him out of town, beats him. When he gets back to his home, he's not safe. The mob that evening comes to his own land, takes him, lynches him, burns the house, and makes the family scatter into the woods, and thus seizes the 200 acres of land that he owned. That happened in 1875. The Equal Justice Institute, the reason I know that story is because the first column that was erected as a part of this was a column with his name on it, because his story was told. His family carried that story with them for 3 and 4 generations out of fear. And this is the place where that story was finally told. Why do I say this is optimism? Because the truth is being told. And to me, we as truth-loving people should always celebrate, no matter how painful, when the truth is actually told. So it's hard to hear, but I want us to know that that's worth celebrating, because that's a part of our history, and that's a part of our journey.
Just along those lines, as you drive into Oklahoma from the north, there's a rest area that is sort of a, well, it's a tourist welcoming place, mm-hmm. and it's got, and they sell books and all this stuff in there. And I was just browsing this last time through, picked up a book that actually tells the story of what happened in Tulsa.
Yep.
And, you know, I never knew that.
Right.
And I thought, well, this is remarkable that here we're going to find this in this place that's trying to promote Oklahoma.
Right. And to me, the more we tell the truth, the more we can actually deal with the differences between us and deal with the hard situations. So another sign of optimism, black folks that go in the woods with white folks, but I'm a black person in the woods with white folks.
With white folks. I wondered about that.
Right?
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So, I mean, you tell the truth, right? So I tell Chuck, okay, I trust you. I want you to know I'm violating every single rule, right? But I'm already here, so, right? But as I shared with him, what it takes is vulnerability on my part and trustworthiness on your part. If I'm willing to be vulnerable and you are trustworthy, I trust myself with you, and that's a powerful moment of testimony, right? And that kind of optimism, that gives me optimism, and I hope it gives you optimism, too, to recognize that that's how we build, those are snippets of the beloved community.
Okay, and along the lines of getting the stories out, in Maryland, there's a new, fairly new museum about Harriet Tubman.
Yes.
And there's a new book, well, maybe in the last couple of years, but there are lots of books, but they've gotten her record from this recording, you know, a verbal, because she couldn't read or write. But we know her as, you know, getting people out, but she, from slavery, but she was also a nurse in the Civil War. And then she was a spy in the Civil War.
A Union spy.
And then she was organizing.
Mm-hmm.
She was a big organizer, knew all the big people. And it's just amazing. And she'd been beat so much when she was a slave. She had a serious concussion. She has seizures her whole life.
Yep.
Then she finally owned land. She had a whole hospital for people who had nowhere else to go.
Right.
It just goes on and on.
And you should read her autobiography. They recorded, you know, her autobiography, and someone voice recorded this so that you can listen to it. But read her call story, right? She's not a minister in the sense of she's ordained clergy, but she certainly articulates a clear call to ministry.
Yes.
She says point blank, God called me to do this work. And I don't, you know, that it's just a powerful testimony about my part, what I can do. I am responsible, and this is what I'm going to do. She was known that if you had doubts, if you were a slave and we got so far away from the plantation, you had doubts, she'd put a shotgun in your face and say, you better keep walking north, there's no going back.
Yeah, that's right.
You made a choice, because it couldn't risk you going back and never caught. The other thing I'll say about the EJI is that, so you've got 800 plus columns. There are a duplicate set of columns that are not hanging that are available for counties to come and pick up. Mm-hmm. So, but the catch is the county must do the work first. Mm-hmm. So they have to do the research. They have to track down what land was taken. They have to know where the lynchings took place. They have to do all that work. Then they can go, and there's a ceremony in which they pick up the count, they pick up the column, and they place it in a prominent place, not in a museum, not in some tucked away corner, but in a prominent place that, so that there are two places. There's a national place, and then there's a column. To date, only 3 counties have done that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I talked to the docents there, and they said there are about 100 counties who have expressed interest thus far, and they've started the work themselves. And so there are communities that are doing this work there. My home county, where my family from North Carolina is from, is represented there. Both of my home counties, my maternal grandmother and maternal grandfather's side, are represented. You think of the state, there's a county represented, like Wyoming and Alaska.
Duluth, Minnesota.
Duluth, Minnesota. So if you go, be prepared and record the names. And what you discover there is the African-Americans who are there are taking pictures of the columns and then making phone calls. And people are discovering for the first time that a relative was actually lynched. Right? What is most important, just like the South African Truth Reconciliation Commission, what is most important is that the truth is told. Right? That's the most important thing. A glimpse of the beloved community in Dr. King's day about being neighbor. And we find this spot here. Yeah, so he says, I'm gonna read, I put a little bit so I can read the rest. Morality cannot be legislated. We've heard part of some of this before. Morality cannot be legislated, but behavior can be regulated. And I want to say that statement is being argued right now today, right, when it comes to the so-called argument about religious freedom, right? I don't have to serve somebody that my religion says, such and such and so forth, right? So this is a prophetic statement here. Morality cannot be legislated, but behavior can be regulated. Judicial decrees may not change the heart, but they can restrain the hardness. I love that. The law cannot make an employer love an employee, but it can prevent him or her from refusing to hire me because of the color of my skin. The habits, if not the hearts, of people have been and are being altered every day by legislative acts, judicial decisions, and executive orders, one way and the other, right? Let us not be misled by those who argue that segregation cannot be ended by force of law, right? Because the legislation, for him, was the place where, and this is, to think of this in the 1950s and 60s, it's quite ironic. On one hand, you have the Vietnam War in the 60s being waged, in which the government is overtly lying to the American populace. But on the other hand, you have Dr. King, at least early on, this sermon was first preached in the late 50s, early 60s, saying the government is the only thing that is keeping us from being a segregated community by institutionally stopping us, right? What an incredible irony that on one hand, segments of the population are fundamentally distrusting the government. And on the other hand, legislation is what we need. And it's the right legislation. I don't know if you find that ironic, but I do. that this is what happens. Now, of course, later in his ministry, he's going to come out against the Vietnam War for reasons of being pacifist and rejecting violence. But the fact that beloved community in this instance is being initiated by government is laughable these days, but is possible. And I think that's what we need to look at and say that this is still opportunity for us. I want to tell a story of Emory Fellowship. Some of you heard me talk about this in the sidebar conversations. Emory Fellowship is a congregation, United Methodist congregation of about 400 people. In 1993, it was a congregation of about 22 people. The pastor, Joe Daniels, came to that church, and to give you a sense of orientation, in Washington, D.C., one of the major thoroughfares is Georgia Avenue. Georgia Avenue runs from the mall at 7th Street, right at the mall, the entire length of the city, north-south, all the way up to Maryland. And so it goes from government buildings to Howard University is on Georgia Avenue. There are several prominent residential communities on Georgia Avenue. Emory Fellowship sits on Georgia Avenue. In 1993, Georgia Avenue was the drug corridor. And so there was a lot of drug activity, a lot of homelessness, and the church was surrounded by dilapidated buildings, and was a known place for all sorts of nefarious activity. Joe Daniels became a pastor and immediately started to work trying to save a dead congregation. He cut the grass, for example, that was about 4 foot tall out front. Took the beer bottles and the needles out of the churchyard. But the other thing they noticed was that there was a lot of homeless who needed assistance, and they started housing them in the church. The church did not have Sunday school space other than two classrooms. They had Sunday school in the sanctuary, and they turned their Sunday school classrooms into transitional housing and put beds in there. So every night, they'd open the doors, homeless folk would come in with their stuff, sleep. They'd have bathing opportunities in the showers in the basement, and then leave in the morning. One day, a few years in his pastorate, the congregation experienced a series of break-ins. So someone would break into the basement windows and come in and tear up things, maybe steal some stuff. What do you think would happen in most of our churches when that would happen?
We'd stop
the program.
Stop,
right? Yeah. So then, but at Emory, at a trustee meeting, one of the trustees said, well, if they're breaking windows, that means they want to get in. We might as well unlock the door. So they left the doors unlocked. The break-in stopped. The thefts stopped. That was an opportunity they realized, you know, maybe we're called to serve this community, dealing with homelessness. In 1998, they discerned that they wanted to build and transitional housing. So they bought several properties, renovated them, and made them transitional housing, but they realized it wasn't enough. And so they developed a 501c3 that went on, fast forward, to partner with Washington, D.C. And HUD to build 99 units of affordable housing on the same spot that the church sat on. There's a $56 million project. The church raised only $500,000. The rest of the money was given through public-private partnerships, including a $25 million grant from HUD. It took about 22 years to happen, but as of this past April, there's a 3-year waiting list and all 99 units are filled. And the church was also rebuilt in that process and is now looking to build another unit across town in a similar model. To me, listening to the board chair of Emory Fellowship, she's actually the chair of the Beacon Center, which is their 501c3. She had been a member of Emory Fellowship. Emory United Methodist Church goes back to 1902. She was born in Emory Fellowship. She was raised in Emory Fellowship. By the time of 1993 came along, she was a 55-year-old bank executive. And all she did was love her church, but it was dying. She didn't know what to do. On the Sunday that they moved into the building, she wept and said, this is what God wants. This is what God has called us to be. This is why we did not die in 1993. It was for today. And then she said, I'm ready to do it again. At this point, she's 70 years old, retired, but she's like, I'm ready to do it again. Like, I'm energized with new life. And she said out of her own mouth, so don't get mad at me, I'm not old yet. There's still a whole lot left for me to do, and I'm excited about the next phase of whatever this ministry is going to be for us. To me, that's a sign of loving our neighbor and bringing about beloved community. As much as we as Protestants love our buildings, Emory Fellowship, before they were even thriving as a church, gave their building up to their neighbor. Can you imagine such a thing? Most of us, when we bring those people in, we get complaints about the carpet and the smell, right? As one woman said, it goes with the territory. It is what it is. That's why God made deodorant. And so Emory never had, they had these discussions that went on. And if you came to Emory and you started complaining like that, you quickly realized Emory wasn't the church for you. They just weren't the place for you. Go, there's another Methodist church up the street, you can try that one. But here, we smell, one person said. The most powerful testimony I heard that day was of a homeless individual who's now transitioned into housing, and he drives a van, and he said, you know, when I met Emory Fellowship, it was three times a week under the 14th Street Bridge, when they drive up, and I saw a white van that said Emory Fellowship on the side. And the back of that van would open up and it'd be hot soup. And he said, the first thing that struck me is that they brought the soup to us. They didn't tell us to go cross town somewhere. They drove the van to us. And he said, I've eaten a lot of soup as a homeless individual. This soup was homemade. This wasn't Campbell's, I could tell. He said, and the thing that really got me, and he teared up as he was telling the story, he said, they put in the little bag, we had sandwich, a cup of soup, and he said, and some water, and he said, the thing that really always struck me was that there'd be a church peppermint. He said, and that, he held up the peppermint. He said, that peppermint said to me I was a human being, that I would want something sweet. That somebody thought enough about me as a human being to put a piece of candy in my bag. That to me just said, that's what it means to treat your neighbor as yourself, right? And so he connected with Emory Fellowship. You know what Emory put him to do? They sent him off to, they realized he had a little driving experience because he used to drive a taxi cab and drove a truck. And got sick and then couldn't work anymore and became homeless. So you know what they started doing with him? He now drives the van. Made sure his license was up to date and all that good stuff. He drives the van and then started driving, surprise, Uber. He lives in the building. Right? But these are real life stories. But what did it cost? In the story of Equal Justice Institute, it costs us our narrative. This is me saying. The narrative of America being the same for everybody, that narrative you have to just let go of, because it is not the same for everybody. Right? In this example, what did it cost? $56 million. And 20 years. And a whole lot of prayer. But the beauty is that the church of 400 people leases to a developer that runs the building. And DC Housing manages the building. So now the church has an endowment. Whereas 20 some odd years ago, it was about to close. What other things might it cost this congregation to do this work? But what does it cost if you've done this work in your communities? What does it cost?
Division of families.
Division of families.
Yeah. It cost us our fellowship hall and our kitchen to build. We built 59 units of affordable housing.
Which then cost people's memories of those places.
That's right.
We had our wedding reception in that fellowship hall. Yeah, but y'all aren't even married now, so what does it matter? You tell I've been a pastor.
So,
yeah,
question: how integrated is the housing units? How integrated are the housing units?
So, mostly African American, because in Washington D.C. Homelessness is about 50% African American, 50% white. Most of the African Americans who live in the building and who were homeless were employed, but they were not employed enough to live. So they lived in their cars or lived in transitional communities. And so they jumped to the list first. It isn't that white folks didn't apply. I think it's a product of several factors about where resources come from and how people found out. I mean, you literally had to go under bridges and tell people about these units. But it's families. Most are single parents raising the families. But you raise a good point about what homelessness looks like in your community.
Yeah. Follow-up question. What's the ratio of SRO, single room occupancy, versus family sized, one bedroom, two, three, four bedroom apartment?
Yeah, it's three bedroom, up to three bedrooms. Efficiency is one, two, and three bedrooms. I do not know the delineation off the top of my head. I could probably look it up. There are, it's a majority one and two bedroom though. There's not that many three bedroom units. So I'm gonna tell a story that Dr. King gives in the sermon, Antidotes for Fear. This is the sermon that talks about the way that we depend on each other, but are also, the way we depend on each other to be affirmative to who we are, not as leeches, but more so as strength-building partners. One of the most dedicated participants in the bus protest in Montgomery, Alabama, was an elderly Negro woman we affectionately called Mother Pollard. Although poverty-stricken and uneducated, she was amazingly intelligent and possessed a deep understanding of the meaning of the movement. After having walked for several weeks, she was asked if she were tired. With ungrammatical profundity, she answered, "My feet is tired, but my soul is resting." On a particular Monday evening, following a tension-packed week which included being arrested and receiving numerous threatening telephone calls, I spoke at a mass meeting. I attempted to convey an overt impression of strength and courage, although I was inwardly depressed and fear-stricken. At the end of the meeting, Mother Pollard came to the front of the church and said, "Come here, son." I immediately went to her and hugged her affectionately. "Something is wrong with you," she said. "You didn't talk straight tonight. You didn't talk strong tonight." Seeking further to disguise my fears, I retorted, "Oh no, Mother Paula, nothing is wrong. I'm feeling as fine as ever." But her insight was discerning. "Now you can't fool me," she said. "I knows something is wrong. Is it that we ain't doing things to please you? Or is it that the white folks is bothering you?" Before I could respond, she looked directly into my eyes and said, "I done told you we is with you all the way." Then her face became radiant and she said in words of quite certainty, "But even if we ain't with you, God's gonna take care of you." As she spoke these consoling words, everything in me quivered and quickened with the pulsing tremor of raw energy. But as the years have unfolded, the eloquent, simple words of Mother Pollard have come back again and again to give light and peace and guidance to my troubled soul. God's going to take care of you. He talks about Mother Pollard in this way as being the embodiment of beloved community. That as an old woman, she sees the leader and pours into him from a place of her own strength. Mm-hmm. And in the process, invigorates him for the next step in his journey.
She sees him as human, though.
Right. Where he's trying to mask, yeah. Right? And I think for those of us who are pastoral leaders, that lesson is very important. Because don't ever believe the hype, pastors, that you know we're supposed to be strong for everybody else. And, you know, to not be strong and to show any vulnerability is to show weakness. And that's not really true. And you don't bleed out on your parishioners, but you don't have to be a fortress. The song says the mighty fortress is our God, not our pastor. And so being able to recognize that you're human as a pastoral leader means you're able to make yourself vulnerable and be interdependent with your people, not codependent with them. So I often hear, pastors are the worst people to compliment. Pastors do not take compliments well. You tell a pastor, really good job. Oh, that's not me, that's the Lord. That was a really great sermon. Oh, well, praise God, I just was humbly praying and I hope that you got something right. Just say thank you. Right? We have a tough time doing that. It's hard. Because we don't want to be come off as obnoxious and grandiose, but at the same time, we hear you and we receive that. I tell my students all the time, being a good self-differentiated person, use Ed Friedman's language, is to say, thank you and receive the love of the congregation, but not let that love define who you are, right? And that takes maturity, right? Because if you don't do that right, then you start to lead from manipulative places to get the love that you're trying to get back to. And so, she sees him as human. And for lay folks, you need to see your pastor as human. And for many lay folks, we see our pastor as human/flawed. So we emphasize the flawed side of it, right? You're not perfect. Yes, we know that, right? But instead, see them as persons who are vulnerable, who have given their lives to these institutions and struggle just like you struggle, cry just like you cry, who have feelings like you do. I had to have a shouting match with a parishioner one time who I came in sweatpants and a hoodie. And I'd run it in from another meeting and I just ran in like I was. And so she stopped me and, I'm the young assistant pastor. And so she just looks at me and says, well, don't you look like a thug? Excuse me? Oh, it was a joke. I didn't find that funny. Oh, you can't take a joke? Oh, I can. It wasn't a joke because it wasn't funny. Right? And then it became, would you talk to the senior pastor who's about 20 years older than I am? Would you talk to the senior pastor like that if he came in his sweatpants? Well, no. There's the problem right there. Do you know what a thug is? No. So I went to, I was mad. So I pulled the full bore of my education off. It was rooted in the 1300s in India, in a cult of such and such, went through the whole thing, right? Her eyes were this big. And so then she finally said to me, I'm sorry, I thought I was making a joke. But I see now, all right, that I was in error. Yes, you were. You were. And I forgive you for that. Let's not do that again. Right? Interdependence. Two quick stories. They come from Baltimore. So we know in May of 2015 about the story of Freddie Gray and his death at the hands of the police, Baltimore Police Department, that has resulted in a week of uprising. That uprising started in a neighborhood called Sandtown. Sandtown is an impoverished community in southwest Baltimore. It's actually within walking distance of the Baltimore Harbor, if you've ever been to Baltimore. It's less than a mile away from Baltimore Harbor, in fact. But on the corner of the two main streets in Sandtown is the Ames United Methodist Church. Ames United Methodist Church predates much of modern Baltimore. It was actually a church founded in the 1800s, late 1800s. And Sandtown was called Sandtown because there was a brick factory there and the streets were lined with sand from the bricks that were being made. And so it was nicknamed Sandtown. It was a historically African-American community with slaves and subsequently freed black persons. But about six doors down from Ames was Freddie Gray's childhood home. And there, when the uprising happened, it happened in front of the Ames United Methodist Church, because that was the heart of the Sandtown community. The pastor there is a guy by the name of Rodney Hudson. He's been there about a decade. Rodney is not your average pastor. If you see Rodney on any given day, he's probably got a leather jacket on, some dingy jeans, some boots, and a baseball cap. And Rodney is in a church that nobody wants. The bishop can't pay anybody enough to go to Ames University. Sandtown is a dilapidated community that is drug infested, gang infested, and many of the homes still have lead paint in them to this day. But if you walk along the streets, everybody knows Pastor Rodney. Because Pastor Rodney stands on the corner across diagonal from Ames UMC and has prayer meeting on the street. He knows the name of every drug dealer. He knows the name of every prostitute. He knows the name of every family in the Sandtown neighborhood. And when I go and visit with a group of pastors, it is Rodney that makes us safe. Rodney's the one that brokers the deals that allows us to walk the neighborhood. And so having a group of pastors meet with, we'll call him Joe, because that's what he said his name was. Joe was the block captain for the drug gang. Joe is the nicest young African-American man you ever want to meet, who took us on a very detailed walk in the neighborhood. And so you get a sense of community, but at the same time, there's this strange sense of almost a war zone happening. But you know what Rodney says? Rodney says every day there are people in this community that wake up and just try to provide a living for their family. And every day there are people that wake up that are worn out of the situations of drugs, sex trafficking, and all the things that they're going through. And if they want out, I'm pointing to Jesus. They have feeding programs. They have a sustainable education program. And so when the riots happened, Rodney held church, opened the doors of the church, and told those folks, you're angry, you're sad, you're frustrated, this is the place you ought to come. And for 1 week, they packed that house. While others wanted to break glass and all that kind of stuff, they packed that house, and he let those young folks get it out. And in so doing, made them safe in a hostile environment. To me, that's Rodney recognizing that the future of his church, as well as the future of that neighborhood, are interlinked to include the drug dealer. Mm-hmm. Right? So in the midst were drug members, the gang members, and other folks. Everybody in that environment, because that's what the community is made up of, and we are depending on each other, and my drug dealing brothers, we want you to be better. And here's a way out. Our sex trafficking brothers and sisters, here are some resources, right? But we're not asking you to move, and I'm not calling the police on you. I want you to be better. And so he sows in, and he says that was our protest. About 5 miles away on the north side of town is Pleasant Hope Baptist Church. And when the riots happened, the pastor, a guy by the name of Heber Brown, decided that the way that we're going to resist is we're going to build sustainable food and urban gardens. Because our problem in our neighborhood is that we are dependent on what goes on in City Hall, welfare, and other things. No, I'm going to teach my folks how to grow their own vegetables. Right here in the plot of land, that's the churchyard. So the little teeny churchyard, which is about half the size of this room, produces about 1,800 pounds of fruits and vegetables every year. And if you are on welfare, or if you just are on a limited income, and you can't afford fresh fruits and vegetables, you can walk across the street into the churchyard. It's not locked. You can go right into the ground and get some fresh carrots and walk back across the street and put them in your soup. No questions asked. And in the process, he's teaching young people how to be dependent on themselves and on their community to sustain themselves and not on their government. Those are two tales of resistance, both of which are led by the church. Now, if you asked Rodney how many members he'd have, he'd say about 2,500. Because that's the population of Sandtown. If you ask him how many are in worship, he'll say, I don't know. The church is built for 500. He certainly doesn't break over 50 all of a sudden. But his ministry is to Sandtown. And that's why they won't close the church. Because there's ministry happening on that block. Pleasant Hope is a congregation. The sanctuary is about this size. And so this congregation is maybe 70 or 80 people producing 1,800 pounds of fruits and vegetables a year. Doesn't take much, doesn't take a lot. Even Jesus only used 2 fish and 5 loaves. Lastly, really quickly, I'm going to summarize Pilgrimage to Nonviolence. It's a good sermon. It's actually available online if you type in Stanford King Institute. All of Dr. King's papers and speeches are there online. You can search for Pilgrimage to Nonviolence, or you can buy Strength to Love, and you can do that. Stanford's King Institute, Stanford University's King Institute. It's a project of theirs that they've collected all of his documents. It's actually more comprehensive than the King Center in Atlanta. What he essentially says, long story, is that he learned that the liberalist theology that he learned in seminary and the neo-orthodox theology he learned in seminary, both were inadequate to name the movement. And he said it was his journey to India and to learn from Howard Thurman and from the Gandhi Center about this idea of nonviolence that actually helped him to understand that both of the Western theological arguments that were happening were both irrelevant to the movement and insufficient to name what was happening. And so he branches onto, you know, what Gandhi and Hinduism calls ahimsa, active nonviolence, active non-action. And so there isn't a Christian term for that. So it's nonviolence. And he grounds it in the theology of the reading of Jesus Christ's witness on earth. And in so doing, so when people call Dr. King a liberation theologian, that's not exactly accurate, because he would not call himself a liberation theologian. He probably embodies liberation theological perspectives, but his theology is actually much more of he's Boston personalist, which is not even, you know, in his extreme form, not even Christian. He's a liberal theologian, but he's not a liberation theologian. And so he brings all of this together, and that allows him to make multiple partners from across the ethnic and class spectrum. And that helps him to embody in the movement a unity over the differences that we have. And so in the sermon, that's exactly, he's unpacking his journey towards all of this. So I'm quoting the whole sermon because the sermon itself is the teaching about we can be unified over all of our differences. And so finally, I'm going to use the problem at Wesley Seminary's refectory. Our refectory is about twice the size of our dining hall here at Holden. And it seats about 170 or so. And we have lunch and dinner at the seminary. Wesley is a very diverse school, perhaps one of the more diverse schools in the Association of Theological Schools. We are 40% African American. We're about 50% United Methodist. The average age is about 33, 34 years old. Our oldest students are 80, and our youngest students are 21. And we've got about 400 students in enrollment in the master's program, about 200 in the doctoral program. And at mealtime, that diversity is on display. But the tables are segregated. And what I mean by that is, and I'm using that word intentionally because that's the quote-unquote problem that I get because I'm the dean of campus life, is somebody wants me to say, tables are segregated. And so then I say, oh, I didn't know that we had a whites-only table and a colored table. Oh, no, we don't have that. We just, you know, look, all the white people are sitting at this table, and all the black people are sitting at this table, and the Koreans are sitting at that table. That's segregation. Really? Is that segregation? Is there a sign somewhere that says, you must sit collectively, right? So then I have to help people to understand that if you look at the table, if all you're doing is defining by race and ethnicity, then you are limiting your scope about what diversity means. So when they point to the white table, I say, yeah, but she's Presbyterian, he's Lutheran, she's United Methodist, and that guy is agnostic. But they're all white. Yeah, but she's from Florida, he's from Cincinnati, she's from Texas. But they're all white. Okay, but she's 35, he's 60, right? And then it's like, oh. Well, all the black kids are at that table. Yeah, but she's AME Zion, she's AME, she's Baptist, right? If all you do is see race, then you miss the diversity that's in front of you. If all you do is see race. And so then, when they do that, they start looking around, and it's like these glasses come off, and they see that in the room is an incredible diversity. And so I say, so what if all of the young kids want to sit together today? And what I started doing was instituting a connection between the chapel in which we gather at the Eucharistic table as the rehearsal for our dining. That Christ at this table invites all. Whoever wants to come and be connected to a greater reality. And doggone it, if that's what Christ does, then our blessing over in the refectory is be present at our table, Lord, which means these tables are also not ours, but they are also Christ's table. And if you sit down, whether you're white, black, Asian, Hispanic, I'm meeting Christ. And you are invited. That's why it's not segregated. Because if you say, can I sit here? It's just like, can I sit here? Absolutely, I sit. That's not segregation. It's different. But we're still unified under a common banner. Now, what it costs is people's theological understanding of difference and diversity. And most of us, particularly as Americans, only conceive of diversity as race. And how limiting. Because one of the things I can't say, but I do know because of by virtue of my story, everybody at the table might be white, but one person identifies as gay, another person identifies as queer, another person is questioning. I know that, but they don't know that. Right? But the beauty of those moments is that they're talking. And they discover the differences with each other. And then the fact that we're all white at the table doesn't mean much of anything anymore, because I don't agree with anything you just said. And to me, that's the beloved community. That we sit out at the table and we think we have things in common because we're all white, but in actuality, we have nothing in common and we learn from each other in the midst of that. And there are moments like that that we all have at coffee hour, at work, in our Kiwanis clubs, if they're still there, all these kinds of things. They happen, but we miss the opportunities. Instead of the deep probative questions we ask, how is the weather today? And to me, what it costs is a recognition that the world is so much bigger than just race. And beloved community is much broader than just the conception of race that we often get stuck on. I'll leave you with this simple quote. Evil can be cast out not by man alone, nor by a dictatorial God who invades our lives. But when we open the door and invite God through Christ to enter, God is too courteous to break open the door. But when we open it in faith, believing a divine and human confrontation will transform our sin-ruined lives into radiant possibilities.